Mary Helen and Stephanie, thanks for joining me. I want to start with a shared diagnosis that runs through both of your work by drawing on two articles. Stephanie, in getting developmental science back into schools, you and your colleagues argue that many schools, especially those under high-stakes accountability systems, have become organized around control, compliance, surveillance, and behavior management in ways that are fundamentally misaligned with how children actually develop. You argue that schools often treat self-regulation as something to demand from children rather than something schools are responsible for helping children build through relationships, emotional safety, autonomy, practice, and support. Mary Helen, in weaving a colorful cloth, you and your colleagues make a related but even broader argument that modern schooling is still built on a fundamentally reductionist idea of learning itself, one that treats learning as linear, standardized, measurable, and separable from emotion, culture, identity, relationships, and meaning-making. Instead, you argue that human development is emergent, relational, culturally situated, emotionally grounded, and deeply tied to agency and purpose. So before we get into practice, I want to pause on what we may be the deepest implication of both of your arguments and ask you both to talk about them. Your work suggests that schools are not merely transmitting knowledge, they are shaping developmental trajectories, shaping whether young people learn to see themselves as passive performers inside systems designed by others, or as thinkers capable of interpreting the world and managing alternatives, taking perspectives, and acting with purpose alongside others. Your thoughts?
Agreed. So that's the first thing I'd say.
Plus one on that. Okay.
How could we disagree with that?
Yeah.
I do think that there is a kind of funny paradox, if that's the right word, out there in the world of education, which is that there's all this evidence and science about human development that has been around for a long time. Mary Helen and I are trained in similar disciplines and with overlapping knowledge bases and carry a body of knowledge about human development with us that we would probably both suggest is like describes a set of universals. Yet, in the places where children are taught, cared for, and I'm talking like early care and education all the way through, spending their time in many hours a day, there isn't actually a whole system of training and support for adults, adult educators, for system leaders, for administrators, for what have you in child development. Right? But these are settings and contexts and environments that have conditions in them that are shaping developmental pathways, as you just described. Yet the system itself isn't set up to support those working in those places in that system with developmental knowledge. So it's, and I just described it as a paradox. I think it is a paradox. It's like a missing link. Imagine what those settings might look like, how they would feel, the kinds of things that would happen in them if we had a belief and then a system in place that gave those adults the knowledge about child development that might be helpful in how they shape and create those environments. So I think the downside of not having that is that the systems are set up not with child development, learning sciences, like the science of learning and development, David, in your world, that it's not set up with those principles as anchor points. And so those systems become, they start to look strange to a developmentalist. They embody practices that are not supportive of young children's development. So it's a funny thing. And I think there's lots of work to be done to work on that paradox.
I can continue with that argument and say that part of this paradox, as Stephanie is describing it, emerges from a fundamental misunderstanding about what schools are for. And I think we have, in our language and our structures, we have operated on the very fundamental and not questioned assumption that schools are to promote learning. And we measure learning outcomes when we want to know whether school is effective. And what I would argue is that outcomes are not, the learning is not the outcome of school at the ultimate end, right, of the process. Human development is the outcome that we're actually striving for. Learning happens in the service of development. So when we think about the learning processes and then stop as if those are what we're all about without understanding or stopping to really think about how those processes are embedded into developmental trajectories, which are the ultimate aim, but we don't realize that explicitly in our systems. We are dropping the ball halfway to the net on the other side of the court, so to speak. We're not attending to the way in which what I would describe as the experience of learning, the process of learning, what it feels like to think here with these people about these things is actually shaping and potentiating how I experience myself and how I show up in the world and how I think about things and act on things potentially differently for having had that learning experience. And that is the actual outcome. That is the actual aim, but we don't directly name that or describe that. And so when we are failing, when we're having a hard time, when mental health is really poor, when teacher attrition is really high, when students aren't engaged, we try to retrofit the learning outcomes to the failures that we're seeing, but we're missing the really important core, which is that those outcomes aren't diagnostics of the way people experience the world. And that's the ultimate determiner of how the learning changes you going forward.
I spent this morning reviewing a great many longitudinal studies that have been done to try to look at some common points. And I went back again to the Perry preschool study. And it's really interesting because of the fact that not only do the young people, when they became adults who went through the Perry preschool, have different outcomes, but so does the next generation, but also when they looked at the different approaches to pedagogy, early on, the approach that used direct instruction actually produced better short-term outcomes. However, it didn't matter in the long run.
Knew
It
it.
didn't matter because the stuff you're talking about was not being developed. And even though I'm not so sure that the young people there had the opportunity to become transcendent thinkers. At the same time, they were having the opportunity to reflect and become the type of thinkers you're talking about.
I think that there's, David, I feel like we've talked about this before. I can't remember, but this idea of taking self-regulation as an example, and some of the work we did in the paper that you just described, the getting developmental science back into schools and self-regulation and that whole thing, that imagine self-regulation is a stage salient developmental task. It's the work of young children, right? It's the work of the early childhood period is to learn regulatory skills and strategies and to practice those in the places where you live and learn, right? And if young children at that key time are in settings where their behavior is hyper-controlled, where they're not given opportunities to practice those skills at the time when their brain is ready to practice them, the setting, the demands of the context are all primed for a child to be learning those skills and practicing them. If they don't have that opportunity, they may learn the things that they're supposed to be learning in that direct instruction environment, but they won't have the chance to practice that stage salient developmental skill that's really necessary for the stuff that comes later. So they might learn through direct instruction all the letters and the sounds that they make. And then they proceed along, and folks are thinking, wow, this is really great. They're really learning a lot of things. And they arrive at third grade at the moment of a transition to a level of independence in, let's say, reading. But what hasn't come along is that regulatory capacity that supports the independence necessary to be an independent reader, right? And so what happens is that it looks like all of that reading stuff falls apart. When in fact, the set of really important skills that support all of those academic tasks and skills have not been cultivated and supported, and so they're not available when they're needed later to support something else. And I don't know, I think that is the crux of like, how do we get developmental knowledge into the practices and the conditions and the pedagogies of the learning environment in a way that supports what's important at the right times when it's important?
To build on that with an example from slightly older kids, we have a study I really like that was with a PhD student at the time in my lab, Solange de Nervaux, who came to do this study with us. She's from Geneva, Switzerland, and she was a fully trained and experienced Montessori school teacher in Geneva, where this is a very well-regulated thing. And she did a really nice study of 8 to 12-year-old kids math problem-solving in an fMRI scanner. And the kids were from Montessori schools and from matched public schools in the same neighborhoods. And she did a whole lot of stuff in the families and with the books and how much do you go to museums and all that. Why are you in that school? Why'd you send your school? All that is matched. And so we had 8 to 12-year-old kids solve math problems in the MRI scanner. What we found is that first thing, the Montessori and the traditionally schooled kids got the same number of math problems. So you could just stop there and say, well, learning outcomes are the same. We're all good. It doesn't really matter. Everybody's learning enough math. It's fine. And let me be clear, if the learning outcomes hadn't been the same, you would need to know that. If one group of kids was far outperforming the other in the number of math problems they could do right, that would be something you would need to address, right? But they're the same. That's not enough. So what we also found out is that the Montessori kids were getting far more wrong because they didn't skip anything they weren't sure of. They took a whirl at whatever came along their way, whereas the traditionally schooled kids, if they weren't really confident, they didn't try. And then what happens is when they get something wrong and get something right, we see very different neural activity going on. So when the Montessori kids get something correct, we don't see much at all, right? They're like, yeah, next thing, I thought so.
Right.
When they get something wrong, we see all of a sudden structural connectivity. That means the anterior cingulate, which is whoo, part of the brain, like, whoa, pay attention, right? Starts talking to the right parietal lobe, which is the like, wait, how do I do math and like process numbers and quantities and spaces, and the frontal lobes that are like, let me strategize about this. So they're like, and they're processing and they're thinking, and then the next time they move on more quickly, and then the next time they're significantly more likely to get it right. They don't get the same thing wrong twice. The traditionally schooled kids, when they get something right, we see massive connectivity all of a sudden between the center and the anterior cingulate and the hippocampus. It's, oh my God, remember that. That's correct, right? Memorize that would be consistent with those data, right? I don't know what they're actually doing, but that would be consistent with those data. And when they get something wrong, we just see like the equivalent of a neural freakout fit, tons of like negative emotion. They pause for too long, they get stuck, they can't restart. And then when they restart, they are not more likely to get it right the next time they see it. So what you have there is a really clear demonstration of, I think, what Stephanie's talking about at, in an academic domain in an older kid, right? Where the culture of the learning environment, the way in which kids are taught systematically to grapple with ideas, materials, concepts with each other as they're teaching themselves how to understand these mathematical concepts is producing the quote unquote same amount of math knowledge, quote unquote, with all the little bunny ears, as kids who are being taught by a teacher, here's how you do it, try it, let me see your paper, yes, you got it right, no, you got it wrong, fix that, back and forth, where it's much more about the teacher helping you lead you through, and you follow the path they set for you, and that's learning math, right? And what our study showed with machine modeling of the patterns of answers that Montessori and traditionally school kids were showing by behaviorally in the brain is that over time, extrapolating out, the Montessori kids would have significantly more learning from the same school opportunity. Right? So the idea that learning outcomes captures things is deeply tied to the way in which we understand the processes of learning, which is really what Stephanie's alluding to, I think, when she's talking about things like executive function and autonomy support and managing yourself through the process. And what does it feel like to think about things? Another thing that Solange showed that I think speaks here to the sort of cultural ways in which kids regulate themselves in the learning process. Solange did another very clever thing where she stuck up the picture of a friendly adult in the corner of the picture of the math problem, right? And there's just like an adult watching you do it. That makes no difference to the Montessori kids. They go right along just the same. There's no difference in the way they're solving problems. The traditionally schooled kids, all of the patterns I showed you before become exacerbated. They're like, oh my God, don't take a step. Don't try. You're not sure. There's an adult standing there. You could screw up. They are regulating themselves via the adult's imposition of structures for compliance onto them. And that, I would argue, is shaping not just how much they know, which is what learning outcomes measures, but how they come to know it and what it means for their development as learners over time. Great
Yeah.
study, right? It's a cool study.
It's so cool. And
Yeah.
it just underscores the process mechanism, the process and kind of mechanistic elements of the learning in contrast to what often frames how we talk about learning, which is like the what, right?
Yeah.
Did you learn this? Did you learn this? Did you learn this? And I often think about this example in like early childhood classrooms where there's like a lot of work on the calendar. Like in the morning, it's okay, let's do the calendar and we're going to talk about the calendar. And I'm like, what a wonderful ritual. Maybe that's a habit that's a way for children to come together and get into the room and transition and all that stuff. But the calendar, as the knowledge of the calendar doesn't matter, right? That is a technical thing that will be learned if we really were doing it to emphasize the process of coming together and hearing each other talk about what's happening on this day or that day, or predicting what might happen the next day, these sort of mechanistic process features that are tied to learning things, as opposed to does everybody know that it's Monday? That, anyway, I totally agree with you, and that is a really interesting study.
I think what's particularly interesting about that study and a lot of other things that are pointing in the same direction now is that the difference is being like neurologically we're studying, and the difference is being really framed as it's the feeling of the learning itself that is shaping the process by which you engage. And that's how I really see emotion being part of this. It's the experience of being wrong, of being right, of what you care about. The Montessori kids don't care about being wrong or right. They care about understanding math, right, at the broad level. Whereas we're teaching our kids that outcomes are what matters. That's what you care about. And so you aim for that. But when you're caring about outcomes, that's what you learn about is outcomes, not processes, which is what you're talking about.
Totally.
Building on the insights that you both have provided, and knowing right now that many teachers have not been prepared with the background in developmental science that Stephanie was talking about at the beginning, for teachers who are facing things right now, what might be one important thing for them to really become aware of that might start to help them transform their practice? And it can be more than one, but at least what would one thing be?
We're doing studies of this right now, David. So we've got teachers from all across the country coming together and working intensively with us in these design sprints. We're calling co-labs, part community of practice, part laboratory, right? Where teachers are working with us to what we're calling metabolize the developmental science into nutrients and energy, so to speak, for meaningful innovation in place-based, context-dependent ways. So we're not coming up with best practices. Instead, what we're doing is helping teachers understand what development looks like at the age in which they're teaching, and we're focusing specifically on adolescents, so secondary teachers, middle and high school, and what those mental and emotional and social cultural processes look and feel like, and what you can see when kids are engaging in them, and then design backward from that to make those experiences readily available opportunities for the students. So one of the things that we did was to go into schools, and these papers are one just accepted, it should come out very soon, and the other one is under review. We have a study of fMRI actually with teachers from across the LA region, public middle and high school teachers from very low SES areas with high levels of crime. And we went into these schools and asked the administrators, who are your awesome, most committed, most super duper teacher, whatever that means to you, the ones the kids really love, learn from, right? And we invited 40 of these amazing people from all over the city, right, to come and be part of a study with us. And they all did. They're so gracious and lovely. But one of the things we did with those teachers was to have an independent study of both their classroom practices done by a team that was separate from us, right? Who went into the classrooms, videotaped, and there's lots we're doing with that, and watched what the teachers were doing and talked to the kids and interviewed the teachers and had questionnaires given to the kids about their experiences of learning and all this stuff. And then the teachers came to the lab, and we, not having seen their classrooms, we talked to them about how they understand their work, how they conduct their work, what kinds of practices they use and why. And then we also had them do MRI scanning while they did some things from their work. We worked with them to make a very open-ended formative assignment for their class along the form of this week we've been learning about, right? It could be anything. So it works in any subject area because all the subject areas were included. Why is this important and interesting? Tell me the big idea about all that kind of stuff. And so we got the assignments from the kids directly and we gave it to the teachers in the scanner and asked them to grade their kids' work. And then we had them grade other assignments that we said were just from the internet. The kids you don't know, just grade them. And actually, we had written those ones to match the level of their real students, but it's not their real students. Here's Mary Helen's paper, grade it. Here's Stephanie's, here's David's, grade it. Here's Richard's. Here's some kid off the internet, just grade it. What we found is that these teachers graded the two matched assignments equivalently. So, in other words, they were being objective, quote unquote, or systematic, right? But we see massively more neural activity to their own students in all the social, emotion, and physiological regulatory brain regions that we're seeing in teenagers are associated with growth of the brain and mind with psychosocial outcomes, right? The same things. And the really interesting thing is we also asked these teachers outside the scanner to give feedback to a random selection of kids from their class, high, middle, and low performing girls and boys and whatever. Here's your student, Stephanie. What would you say to Stephanie? Just, oh, Stephanie, I think you're doing great. Please do your homework, blah, 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 whatever, right? Here's Mary Helen. And we coded that feedback. And what we found is that some teachers were much more developmentally oriented in that feedback, where others were more associated with their comments were more focused on compliance and helping kids complete the work and manage themselves actively in the classroom, like advocate for themselves and those kinds of things. So some teachers were saying things more, Stephanie, you're really doing great. I think you can push yourself a little bit more, but like, I just keep doing what you're doing. You advocate for yourself. You get stuff done on time. Yay, you're a perfect student, right? Keep going, right? Or they might say, like another teacher said something like, Stephanie, I can't help you. You never do your work. I have to just chase you and tug and pull and I try, but if you don't have the diligence to do it, you got to work on that diligence, right? Whereas other two teachers said things like, Mary Helen, I think you've got amazing ideas, but I want to see you really work on your intellectual courage. And what does that look like? That looks like sharing your ideas with your peers in your class and listening and valuing the comments they make on your ideas, and then thinking about your own ideas and then re-entering into the conversation and really leveraging your peers. She doesn't use the word leveraging, right? Using your peers as a way to improve your own intellectual courage and ability to share and think with others. Go work on that for a while, right? And what we find is that it's the developmental orientation of the teacher's feedback that explains the difference in neural activity between the two conditions. In other words, the teachers who are showing the biggest increase in activity when they're grading their own students versus students they don't know off the internet are the ones with the most developmentally informed perspectives when they get feedback. What that teaches us is an answer to your question, right? What do we want teachers to really notice and think about as they move into these developmental orientations? There are questions they can ask themselves. Ask yourself, what does it feel like to think here? Not just what are the emotions that are being had here? People are frustrated, they're excited, they're happy, they're whatever. That's fine, but I think that's not as important actually as what are the emotions that we're having here about? Are they about outcomes mainly? Got the outcome, didn't get the outcome, failed, flunked, amazing, A plot, whatever? Or are they mainly about ideas? Because if the emotions are what you're thinking about, and what you're thinking about is what you could learn about, then what the emotion's about is what you could learn about. And if the emotions are about outcomes, that's what you're learning about. You're learning how to do school and produce outcomes. If the emotions are about ideas, they're about the actual why the ball is rolling down the ramp, and there's this hidden force in the background that makes the moon pull the tides and our feet stick to the ground, and it's actually this thing you can't see, but you could measure it by rolling this ball. Whoa, how cool! If you get that emotion, then what you're learning about is the actual concepts of physics, right? So ask yourself as a teacher, what are the emotions about here? And that goes a long way to helping get into this developmental mindset, I would argue. And then the other thing that I'll lay on the table is if you were to ask kids after they do their work, comes from my colleague and classmate, Kim Sheridan. I think this is so brilliant. If you ask kids at the end of a project, at the end of their work, what would you do next? Do they have a good answer? Because if they have a good answer, it shows what I would call a process orientation to the learning, right? Yeah, there's an end point. There's a stopping point where I showcased my work, I finished the project, whatever. But what I learned is this: next time I do it that way, I try this next to move on beyond what I did here. Tells you that you are on a process-oriented developmental track. If they don't really know what they would do next, like this is done, what's your, I don't get the question, that signals to you that you've got an outcome-oriented approach, and start getting kids to think about how they would do something next as a way to get them into a process.
Stephanie.
I think it's so interesting to listen to Mary Helen talk about this. My version is not dissimilar, but just a little simpler. Like my more simplistic mindset is going to reveal itself right now. So I wrote down four things. And I imagine like any teacher could take this idea and just say, okay, for 10 minutes, anybody can do anything for 10 minutes, pretty much. I'm going to try this. And here are some four things that you might try that are related to the ideas that Mary Helen just shared and backed with this really interesting evidence and neuroscience. So the first is ask kids about their thinking, invite them in. Second, notice what they're doing well. And this sounds simpler than it actually is, which is that one thing that we found in our social emotional learning work is that there are kids who are never noticed for things they do well in classroom. They're only noticed for things that they need to do differently or correct or that are not going well. And so, really practicing as the adult in the room to notice what's going and say it. So try noticing what's going well for every single kid. You can even pick a kid every day, and you're going to give yourself the personal task of identifying something that's going well. You will see it. And if you call it out to that kid, it could be transformative for them because some kids never get that. And when they do, it makes a big difference for them. The third is model yourself when it gets hard. Model in your behavior what you might do when things get really difficult. So I've seen educators in classrooms when they feel like it's all getting crazy and falling apart, they say, "Kids, I'm noticing that I'm losing control. And so what I'm going to do is take a minute and sit down and breathe deeply three times because I'm feeling in this setting that I'm losing control because of what's happening here. So I'm going to do something to calm down and then I'm going to do something about that situation." And it's revelatory because kids see adults facing the same things they face and needing to engage the same strategies and tools to get out or get through it, get out of it. So ask kids about their thinking, notice things that are going well, model in your own behavior what you do when things get hard. And then the fourth, I would say, is it's a little bit related to the first, but inviting kids into the design of the work. We're going to talk about X today. And I'd love to hear from all of you what you're thinking about X and how might we join together to work on it. Let's get some ideas. And in a way, each of those things is about this process of engaging in the learning as opposed to a, like hyper focus on the outcome that derives from it, right? Because that's what we want to build in kids and adults, I would say. So those are my four.
As I listen to what both of you have said, I've deepened my understanding of some of your thinking. So, Mary Helen, I was always taken with, I think it was a 2008 article, I Feel and Therefore I Learn.
My first postdoc paper with Antonio DiMaggio, 2007.
It's, okay. And, but it's not just, if I hear you today, it's not just I feel and therefore I
It's
learn.
we, not I, but
I think
yes.
we, and
Yep.
also it's what we're feeling about
That's
that
right.
also drives it. So I think it's
Absolutely.
another dimension, okay? Because I think it's important for people to understand the fact that emotions matter and they really drive learning. But what you are adding that I'm hearing today is also what the emotions are about.
Is driving what the learning's about,
That's
right?
right.
It's just
Yes.
another way to say what you're
That's right.
saying.
That's
Exactly.
right. And Stephanie, even though you were being very simple in terms of breaking it down, what you're doing is really creating the ways in which learners can be invited into the processes that Mary Helen's describing. Yeah. So let's go further. How would you begin to redesign learning environments? So we're not just talking about what a teacher can do tomorrow, in ways that cultivate deeper forms of thinking, reflection, agency, and meaning making, not as an enrichment for a few students, but as something that is really part of the natural fabric for all students.
Who starts?
Which is the hardest question that he's asked. We're both silent.
Right. So we are working with, for example, a fabulous school district, Anaheim Unified School District, which is a secondary school district that serves very low SES, first generation American communities, and has really been making a very concerted strategic effort to rework their curriculum around these things they call PSAs. I'm terrible with acronyms. I don't know what it stands for, but they're basically deep projects that teachers design in their subject area for a group of kids and that they carry out over a long span of time and that kids are systematically led through and teachers design their own curriculum around these topic areas that they work on. And teachers are just coming to learn these new ways of doing things. Some of the teachers are quite skilled at it and really quite adept. Others are, it's a real switch. It's a very different way to do stuff. So my dissertation student, Emily Gonzalez, who just graduated this spring, she did her dissertation following 11 of these teachers doing these PSAs for the first time across the school year with an intensive sort of deep dive study where she looked at how these teachers were thinking about the design process before they enacted their project, what was on their mind, how were they designing and around what. And then she followed them, observing the enactment of the project across the weeks. And then at the end, talked about how it went with them and what they would do differently and what they learned and what surprised them and who surprised them and all that. And then also she did collected data from all the kids about and all these different people's classes about their reflections on what they'd learned from the project. And what she found again really echoes what Stephanie said early on, that teachers who in the beginning, there was a lot of range in the degree to which teachers' conceptualization of the reasons why they were designing the way they were at the beginning were deeply tied to their developmental conceptions of kids and to the purpose of school. So teachers with rich developmental conceptions, so that I would define that as teachers who are thinking about how opportunities to engage in academic work are systematically designed to support young people in a kind of coordinated experience of personal and scholarly growth through the work. And so what she found is that teachers with more developmentally oriented perspectives in the design phase leveraged and utilized more expansive practices through the implementation phase, and their kids were more what we're calling transcendent or emergent transcendent in their reflections on what they'd learned. In other words, they understood what they'd learned, not just in terms of the concrete doing it here, but in terms of broader, bigger, personal, future-oriented, deeper kind of conceptual ways of understanding what they had, how they had grown and what they had learned. Whereas teachers who were more framing the purpose in terms of learning outcomes at the beginning enacted more tight compliance-oriented practices through the lesson's lifespan, where they were going around stamping kids' books to make sure they did stage two and like all those kinds of things, right? Not incompetent, that's fine, but it doesn't really encourage a deep developmental engagement with the concepts, right? It's about getting it done. And then at the end, those kids were significantly less likely to speak about their learning experiences in ways that were emergent or transcendent emergent thinking. So, how teachers learn to do this, our data suggests, is deeply tied to how they understand what the purpose is in the first place, which is deeply tied to their ability to see and recognize and describe the processes of development that young people are engaging in, how their opportunities to engage in academic learning are inviting them to experience themselves in a different way, to engage in a process over time that has iterative opportunities for reflection and change and potentiates kids with emergent properties that they wouldn't have discovered in themselves had they not learned that thing in that way at that time. And so we see teachers doing this, teachers learning how to do it, and as they learn, they improve practices in a commensurate way, which in turn improves student experiences of learning.
The only thing I can add to that is circling back to the beginning. Like, how do we set the system up so that this is possible?
Because
Right?
if the structures aren't there, it's impossible to do it.
How do we offer to educators the information, the support, the professional opportunities designed for adult learners? So again, that's like a little bit of a linchpin there, right? Which is that you have to really think about not just how children learn and these kind of processes of learning, but how do adults learn and how do we incorporate that into these opportunities? How can we create the opportunities for adults to learn about child and human development in ways that connect to their practice? Can we set up supports and systems inside of schools and networks and what have you that offer educators communities of support, communities of practice that are really focused on their work, on their professional work. The third leg of this particular stool is what are the kind of supports, again, using that word, for adult well-being? This is not an easy job, despite how we treat it. In our system, it is a hard job, one of the hardest. Takes an emotional toll, physical toll, and how are we supporting adult well-being in the context of this incredibly demanding, high-pressure job?
I'll just add one thing. That was an ancillary incidental finding from the study with the teachers, with their narratives, their interviews. We also really talked to them about that. One of the things that came out was that the teachers with the least developmentally oriented narratives, so the ones who are saying, "Stephanie, just do your work. I tug, I ask, I help," right? Or, "Stephanie, great job. You're a superstar. You do what you're supposed to do." And the teachers with those narratives were also the ones who were expressing the most stress. They were the ones who were most worried for the kids. Most concerned that their kids, if they screwed up, if they fell off the track, they would end up in a like a down a path that would be irreparably harmful to them. They were very stressed. Whereas the teachers who were thinking about developmental capacities of their youth, like how do you learn to think more things, kid, right? One teacher was saying, "I think you get to a place where you run out of things to think, and then you just stop and say, 'I'm done.' You need to learn to think more things. And that's a skill. You can work on it. Here's how you start. Start listening to what other people are saying and value what they're saying and then respond and then think. And the next thing, there you are. You're thinking things," right? They're teaching kids processes for developing themselves and for, I should say, civically engaging with the people around them as assets in their own learning. Teachers who are talking that way aren't stressed. They know that their kids are capable of becoming who they need to be. Their job is not to make that happen for a kid. It's to organize a context that invites kids in and provides the supports and the structures and the feedback so that a kid can do it for themselves. And they truly believe kids can. So they don't feel that urgency and that stress of worrying their kid's going to fail in the same way that the low developmental teachers did.
Well, I was going to say that what's so interesting about what you've described is that there's a kind of meta phenomenology of all of this, which is that teachers who are engaged in that process are engaged in exactly what they're supporting kids to engage in, right?
Yes.
Everybody's doing it, right?
Everybody's, yeah.
I don't think that's just a meta issue. That actually is part of the intellectual process that is going on in meaningful learning communities.
Exactly.
In this episode that is focusing on the science of learning and development and what we know, it's really nice that you brought us here, Stephanie, in the sense that it is ultimately not just about the learner, it's about the teacher as well. And it's about the coaction between and among them. It's also about the affordances for the teachers. And I think in terms of what Mary Helen had just said about those teachers who felt the most stress, if we go back to your article, Bringing Developmental Science In, Stephanie, where you're really talking about also behavioral control in schools, what happens is the more stressed teachers are, the more then their interaction with students also create the type of disciplinary problems that further undermine the learning process. So we have this vicious circle going on. Let
Yep.
me.
It's called the stress cascade.
Yes.
It starts a kind of cycle of negative interactions, more stress, more control, more negative interactions. It's just, yeah.
And I think we can do better for our teachers. And I think we know enough from the good work that many people have done to say we have to create systems that create those affordances for teachers to be able to take the type of risks and not even feeling that they're the great risks, but to let them let go. So let me end with one more question, and it's more personal. You know, that I've talked with both of you about your kids, just about my kids and things like that. And I'm not just thinking about them, but I'm thinking about the people who are listening to this conversation who are educators, but also parents and community leaders, and the young people themselves trying to hold on to a sense of possibility in what for many people right now are really difficult conditions.
No, for sure.
So if you could speak not only as scholars, but also as parents, mentors, citizens, and human beings who care deeply about young people and the future of learning, what gives you hope? Where can we be going now?
I love this question because I feel like I trained to do the work that I do for a long time, and it was lots of parts, and it was really challenging. And then I had kids, and I really learned. Same thing from experiences of being in classrooms as an educator. I really learned then too. And what gives me hope is what I find so, I don't know, exhilarating and hilarious and interesting about all of these developmental phases. I think that what having my own kids and working with kids in classrooms and connecting with young people in different ways, what always strikes me is just how interesting kids are. They have so much to say and to offer. And if we give them a little time, like if we ask them questions and listen to what they say, they offer us so much. And when we throw a little control back to them and offer them opportunities and agency, they step in. They're so skilled in ways that I think are so underappreciated. They can do so many things and take control and be leaders and offer insights and reflect on the world in new and interesting ways. It's just, if we hand over a little to them and let them do some of the things and listen to what they offer in those moments, it's miraculous. And I think kids are hilarious. They're so fun.
Yeah, I was going to say this. I said the kids themselves give me hope. Just like what Stephanie said, kids are infinitely generative, infinitely hilarious, infinitely problematic, infinitely interesting, and they're just filled with energy and idealism and a deep drive to make something of themselves and of the world. And it's merely our job to steer them, right? To provide them the opportunities to. Yeah, to keep them away from the sharp edges, so to speak, a little bit. And then to provide the systematic opportunities for them to engage with the kinds of skills and tools and theories and knowledge and ideas that they may not have had access to just inadvertently, right? And to systematically make those available. And then to just stand back and let them do it. Yeah, the word let comes up again. Let them do it. And you guide, you don't do. You can't make anybody do anything. Anybody who's ever had a 2-year-old knows that. My 2-year-old, now she's 24, God love her, and she's a PhD student. But when she was 2, she had this thing where she would scream at the top of her freaking bloody lungs. And it's like we lived in an apartment. Try to make a 2-year-old stop screaming. It's impossible. Are you going to strangle them? You can't stop them from screaming, right? So
Especially when you're stressed out about how much
Right,
noise they're
exactly. It's
making.
like, so
Never
you
gonna
just
happen.
have to come up with another way to just not react to this. Let her learn to stop herself from screaming. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm saying you can't control anybody at any time. Really, all you can do is set them up to be able to manage themselves and to be able to develop for themselves the skills and the awareness to be able to make good on the potentials that they're building for themselves. And that is an infinitely generative, fascinating, hopeful process.
If we set the conditions, they emerge.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If we don't set the conditions, they emerge also, but they do it in ways that turn out to be counterproductive to what we would like for them, right? They don't sit there waiting for something to happen. They go invent structures and families and social networks and deeply important projects and missions that may or may not be what we think would be ideal for them.
I think this is a lovely way to end a lovely conversation. Thank you both.
No, you're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. This
Thank
was
you.
fun.
There's a river.